forecast from the National Weather Service for this Wednesday, October the 19th, a beautiful fall day, just gorgeous. Sunny this morning, partly sunny this afternoon, a high of 69. Some perspective on that temperature. Normal high this time in October would be 58 degrees. The record high was 81, October 19th, 1953. So 69 will be glorious. Tonight, cloudy and cool, a low of 48. Thursday, partly sunny and cool, a high of 58. Sun is shining right now. Beautiful morning, 52 degrees in Racine, 48 for Kenosha, 44 for Burlington, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 11 minutes after 8, the morning show with Greg Berg up next. Support for the WGTD Morning Show comes from the generosity of the family and friends of the late Frank and Beverly Falduto, two lifelong Kenoshans who devoted much of their lives to the community in general and to WGTD in particular. Frank Falduto played an essential role in creating WGTD over 40 years ago. He later served as station manager and a morning show co-host. Morning Show with Greg Berg, up next.
As someone who owns and loves two golden retrievers, you can probably imagine how much I love a brand new book that has just become before the public here in America called Dog Medicine, How My Dog Saved Me From Myself. It is the true story of Julie Barton, someone who at the tender age of 22 found herself falling into a very, very severe episode of clinical depression. And there are a number of things that, of course, helped her on the difficult road to robust recovery, but no single factor was more significant than the unconditional love that she received from a beautiful golden retriever puppy whom she named Bunker. And the story of that love between them and the enormous difference that Bunker made in Julie Barton's life is told in this remarkable memoir, which also spares very few details in painting the painful context of what made this relationship so important. The emotional difficulties which ultimately led to this descent into depression, and it helps us appreciate all the more the miraculous sort of recovery which has occurred. It has not always been easy, but it has been an affirming, vibrant recovery of health in so many different ways. And it's also the story of what a difference Julie Barton made in the life of this beautiful dog. So I'm very, very excited about this opportunity to speak with the author about Dog Medicine, How My Dog Saved Me From Myself, published by Penguin Books. Julie Barton, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thank you so much for having me.
I should say that I called it a brand new story, but actually this book first emerged, I don't remember exactly the year, from a very, very small publisher and achieved astounding success. And so now has sort of gone on to a second life with a major publisher, namely Penguin. And this is your first full-length book of any kind. This has to be thrilling for you to be enjoying such success, in a sense, so quickly.
Yeah, it's been amazing. I think it's pretty unusual, and I just feel really lucky.
Mm-hmm. I have to add as a personal note that my encounter with your book could not be more timely, in that just yesterday we learned that very, very dear friends of ours just received really sad news about their golden retriever, who happens to be the brother of one of our two golden retrievers. And so very much on my mind has been the important emotional bond that exists between a human being and a beautiful dog. And, of course, that is the story here with you and your dog, Bunker. Ahead of us talking about that, let's lay some historical backdrop here. You take a lot of time in your book to actually lead up to your first encounter with Bunker. And I read in a past interview that someone did with you that one of the hardest things for you to do when you decided to write this story was to find the arc, to build the arc of the story. Can you just say a word about that, about the various possibilities that you weighed before finally deciding to shape the book as you do and to spend so much of the book in those years before you ever even met Bunker?
Yeah. It's such a good question because it's so hard to write your real life into a story that's engaging. But the fact is that we all have stories, and we all have a story that's really remarkable, whether we know it or not. You know, and for years I went, nobody really wants to read about how much I love my dog, and nobody, this was, you know, who would really find this interesting? And in fact, some people would laugh at the idea, and I said, I think I want to write about a book about how much I love my dog, and they'd say, well, that'd be a good kid's book. But no, it was really important to me that this was serious, and it was the truth. The truest thing I knew was that my dog saved my life. And so, you know, the way that I wrote it was I wrote a lot of small scenes. I just would jot down a one-word memory, and then I would spend an hour just free writing about that memory. And then at the end of that, I just had a bunch of jumbled stuff. And so I had to figure out how to really, you know, make the stakes in the story as high as they felt to me in my life. It took a long time. It took a long time, but it was a really beautiful, difficult process.
This depressive episode I mentioned occurred when you were 22 years old. But you describe a childhood that contained a fair amount of emotional pain and fragility. And a lot of that was due to having an older brother who in some ways bullied you, even terrorized you in some respects. I mean, that was a really, really difficult reality for you. And I suspect it wasn't easy to write about that either.
No. No, it really wasn't, because for years, I didn't think it was a big deal. I didn't think it was unusual. I had half a dozen therapists say the same thing to me, say, this is not normal, you know, feeling terrorized in your own home, being chased with knives, feeling, you know, threatened, and just being constantly told you're worthless and nobody likes you and I don't like you and you stink and you're ugly. And, you know, that kind of thing happens between siblings. And so I just thought, well, this is a sibling relationship and we have a rivalry and we don't like each other. And some of that is true, but, you know, trauma is trauma. And the messages that I heard every day as a kid was that I was from my brother, not from my parents. My parents were very loving, but from my brother was, I hate you, and you're not worth anything, and nobody likes you. And I internalized that. And I was a really sensitive kid, and I just took it all in.
Do you ever have any notion of where that all came from?
For him?
Yeah.
You know, it's, I don't know, and I write in the book that, you know, it's not my place to say. I mean, I can guess. You know, our dad worked really long hours and was pretty preoccupied with his work. And I think my brother felt a bit abandoned by him, maybe. And then my mom was home, but she was pretty passive in how she dealt with things and kind of just hoped for the best, didn't really take charge in a way. And so I think he felt adrift. I think he had a lot of strong emotions and a lot of feelings he didn't know how to deal with. And, you know, boys are told don't don't cry, don't get upset, you know, and so he got angry. Mm. And, you know, looking back at it, you know, it's important to emphasize, everyone says, you know, your brother was so awful, and say he was a child. He was a child, and children don't come, you know, evil.
Right.
They come, and if they get hurt, they do things that hurt others. So, you know, it's important to make that point that, you know, as an adult, I can look back and say, God, he must have been really hurting.
Mm. And for you, one source of significant solace was the pets that you had as a child. And nothing gave you more sense of peace and refuge than to close your bedroom door and spend time alone with one of your dogs.
They didn't judge me. They didn't care if I was crying. They didn't think I was stupid and worthless. You know, they loved me, and it meant the world to me to have that.
Mm. This serious episode of clinical depression, as I said, occurred when you were 22 years old. Were there any hints of that lurking inside of you ahead of that, or did that, in a sense, come out of the blue as a real surprise to you and everybody who knew you well?
You know, it had been lurking. It really had. I didn't know. I mean, in 1996, depression wasn't something people really talked about. It wasn't, you know, considered part of the public lexicon yet. And I didn't know what was happening. I just didn't want to be around anymore. But I think that if most people up until the last year, I think most people would have thought I was fine. You know, I mean, depression's an invisible disease, and people who suffer from chronic depression, who, you know, which I do, which I know how to fake it like there's no tomorrow. You know, I can make it seem like I'm completely fine, which is, you know, scary for our loved ones. But, you know, the truth is that I knew that if I was going to survive, I had to be honest. Like, it was a life or death situation, that I was really honest about what was going on inside my head and inside my heart. And I don't know that people knew, but I think by the end people thought something's not right with Julie.
This incident occurred once you had relocated from, you had just graduated from college in Ohio, relocated to Manhattan with high hopes of a successful career there. But then your boyfriend and you break up. I think he breaks up with you, and it's an overwhelming city. And I think it's relatively soon thereafter that you find yourself lying on the floor of the kitchen in your apartment. Just describe to our listeners the extent to which you had fallen into a dark abyss.
Yeah. Well, that day I came home from work, and I remember thinking I could just jump in front of this cab. It would be so quick if I just jumped in front of the bus. And, you know, those kinds of thoughts that scared me, yet they still just popped up everywhere. And I came home and I lay down on the floor. Well, I decided I needed to eat something, so I put a pot of water on the stove to boil. And then the thoughts in my head just, you know, a gentle voice came in and said, just give up. They weren't voices. I wasn't hearing voices. They were my thoughts. And my thoughts were rogue. They had gone rogue. And then they just said, just give up. There's no point. Just give up. And I lied down on the floor. And, I mean, I guess you could describe it as sleep, but it was like I was gone. And I woke up, and my apartment was filled with smoke because the water had boiled down. And I turned off the stove, and then I fell back to sleep. And I was there for 2 days. And I would wake up, and I was very distantly aware. It was like I was above my body. I was distantly aware that I was crying and that I was sobbing. And eventually I got to the phone and called my mom and said, something happened. And she said, stay where you are. I'm coming to pick you up. And then what is the miracle in this amazing process of writing this story is that when I looked back at my old journals and at the AKC records, the same day that I collapsed on the floor was the same day that Bunker was born.
Wow. So your mom drives to New York City, brings you back home, and you are, of course, taken to a psychiatrist. You are put on medication. At some point, it occurs to you that whatever modest recovery perhaps you're beginning to experience, if any, what you think is going to make the biggest difference is getting a dog. Mm-hmm. Describe how that possibility was received by, for instance, your parents. I mean, because on the surface it was maybe something that did not make complete sense.
Yeah, it made no sense. It made absolutely no sense. You know, if you looked at it from the outside, not knowing me, it would be just be like, God, it's the last thing she needs is all this responsibility and, you know, potential chewing and accidents in the house and feeling bad about that. But my parents knew me well enough. You know, my mom in particular just said, yeah, that's a great idea. And my therapist said the same thing. So we went out, and it was something in my mind all along that, you know, I wanted to find a dog, because I knew that the safest I'd ever felt was with a dog, and I needed that kind of companionship really desperately. And I just didn't trust people enough. I really didn't. I trusted animals, and so, you know, I thought, well, if I can find a dog that can be my companion, maybe I can try again at life.
Hmm. You describe in the book the search for just the right dog. And one of the things you'd done at one point is alternate between reading two different books. One of the books was Prozac Nation, but the other was some book about various breeds of dogs, which explained various dogs and even ranked them in certain respects. It was through the reading of this book that you came to realize that perhaps for you a golden retriever would be the perfect match.
Yeah.
What about a golden retriever made so much sense to you at this point in your life?
Yeah. Well, I remember the book was called, I have it right here, it says Your Purebred Puppy, A Buyer's Guide. And I still have it. And it has it. It has, you know, like how easy, how trainable they are and all of those facts, you know, how much energy they have, how much exercise is required, how much grooming is required. But the thing that it said about golden retrievers was it said that they were family dogs. And I thought, I need a family. You know, I had a loving family. I mean, that's not the thing. It's not that I was an orphan. It's not that I didn't have loving parents. I did. But I needed something that was just mine, that was just my little nuclear family that I could start as a young adult.
You describe how you and your mother took a little bit of a trip in search of just the right dog, and the first batch of golden puppies that you investigated, it wasn't quite right. What didn't feel right at that point?
Well, I was still very early in my recovery, and I was so sensitive. I was sensitive to every little nuance. And when we got to this house, there were some kids that showed us where the puppies were. They were in the yard in the pen, and we opened up the pen, and I tried to sort of, you know, call them to me, and they all ran away. They all ran towards the fence and away from us, and I felt rejected. You know, I felt like, well, this isn't. My dog's not here. I mean, they were so cute. They were just these white balls of love, and they were so adorable. But I said that this is, my dog's not here. And, you know, for me being in that fragile emotional state and yet able to turn down an adorable puppy, you know, I kind of felt like I knew I was looking for something. I didn't know what, but I was looking for something, and it wasn't there yet.
So you ended up driving on to a farm in outside of Alexandria, Virginia.
Ohio.
Yeah. And this is a very different sort of breeder with pups that had been raised very differently. In fact, these pups had been kind of, in many respects, let loose. However, they were housebroken. They were trained to come when summoned. So they had received a sort of different kind of care. And you saw, I think it was several different golden retriever puppies, and you were sort of momentarily scared, I think, at the task of perhaps having to just choose one, how difficult that might be. And then describe to our listeners what happened.
Yeah, I thought, well, how am I going to choose? Because also I'd gotten the training book that said, before you get your puppy, there's a sensitivity test, and there's the temperament test, and there's the, you know, pinch between their paws, and there's the, you know, make sure they're submissive, all those things. I thought, well, how am I going to choose? And I get to this farm, and my mom and I pulled up, and we didn't see any dogs. We saw one dog kind of wandering, barking at the car, and the breeder came out, and she said, oh, hold on, and she put her fingers in her mouth, and she whistled. And all these dogs came running out of the woods, and I thought, well, that's cool. but I was standing there. I kind of walked away from my mom and the breeder, and I was standing there, and this puppy, you know, 20 yards away, spotted me, and we locked eyes, and he walked right over to me, and he sat right down at my feet and looked up at me. And so I picked him up, and he licked my nose, and that was it. And it felt like he was saying, there you are. I've been waiting for you, mm-hmm. you know? And I thought, well, I'm either really, really going crazy and I'm imagining this, or this is something I need to trust and this might help me.
Right. You're right. I hadn't been forced to choose. I had been chosen.
Yeah.
This one I said, and your mom and the breeder were at a distance and didn't hear you, and you walked closer and said it a little louder. This is the one. I was sure. And that surge of confidence came as a jolt. It had been so long since I'd felt sure of anything.
Yep.
And so this is the dog, and you go home with him. And there's this really touching scene you describe where just as you're about to leave, you put the puppy down in a sense so it can have one more little moment with its mother and its siblings, mm-hmm. in a sense, saying goodbye. Of course, we don't think of dogs really saying goodbye. But Bunker came right back to you. It's mm-hmm. like he had a connection with you, even in just those few brief minutes.
Yep.
That was unlike the connection he had with his own siblings and his own mother.
Yeah, he was ready to go.
Describe the importance of caring for Bunker and the fact that he was a puppy. I mean, what kind of a difference did that make in terms of how Bunker helped you on the road to recovery? I mean, for instance, what difference would it have been if you'd somehow gotten Bunker when he was 10 years old? Mm-hmm. The fact that he was a puppy, what difference did that make?
Yeah. Well, you know, I think that because he was a puppy, I thought, he's his brand new life, and I can help make his life really, really great. And having that mission felt like, okay, now I have a purpose. And it also felt a little bit like, well, if I can have him have a good puppyhood, maybe I can sort of recall what that would have been like for me. And not that I had a bad childhood, but, you know, you kind of, I watched him grow, and I thought, I'm going to protect you. And in that, I was thinking the same thing about myself. I'm going to protect myself, too, in this process. And then also, you know, for somebody who suffers from depression, you know, every morning of my life, I woke up and I thought, I don't want to do this day. And I didn't know that I felt that until the morning I woke up. The first morning I woke up with Bunker in my life was the first morning I woke up without that, what I call this sort of chest-heavy dread, and it was gone. And the fact that it was gone made me realize that it had always been there, and I thought, the world, there are so many possibilities. The world could be beautiful. I could wake up like this every day. And then, you know, he got me outside, and, you know, instead of sleeping until noon, at 6:30 a.m., I was outside, sitting in the grass still wet with dew, laughing at what a goofball my puppy was, and, you know, praising him for going outside and watching the sunrise. And then I had to feed him, I had to walk him, and I had to train him. And I took all of those things very seriously. And it was my mission, and it gave me purpose, and it made my days worth waking up to.
Hmm. You also tell us that a really important moment in the forging of an even deeper bond with Bunker, and for you to even more deeply understand the difference he was making, was in a sense when you suffered what maybe we can call your first relapse. That is when some of these dark demons kind of surge to the forefront once again. Describe what happened and describe Bunker's reaction to that as you felt these old feelings returning.
Yeah. Well, you know, I'd had him for a few weeks, and the first several days were just great because he was such a wonderful distraction. But it kind of felt like, you know, the test wasn't over. And, you know, a few days of distraction does not, you know, lead to lifelong health. And so I started to worry, you know, maybe a dog can't cure me, and maybe this is just a bad idea. And then I started thinking, well, what if I'm doing this wrong? And all of those negative thoughts that I still fight, honestly, I still work on it every day. But those started to come back. And so I just sat down. I didn't have the tools yet to try to challenge those thoughts or to try to just let them come and go. And so I sat down on my couch in my parents' living room, and Bunker was across the room lying on the floor. And I put my head in my hands, and I just started to cry. And I thought, I'm never going to make it at life. I'm never going to be anything. I don't even know if I'm going to survive. And all these thoughts are going and going and going. And then I feel weight and warmth on my toes. And I pull my hands away from my face. And Bunker had just walked over. He'd walked across the room. And he sat down on my bare feet. And he leaned against my shins. And I looked at him, and he twisted his goofy little face, and he looked at me, and it was like he was saying, like, did that help, you know? It wasn't the way that, you know, another human being would do it, where they would come over and hug you and say, tell me about it, what's wrong, don't cry. You know, he just was like, I'm here. You don't have to explain anything, but your crying doesn't scare me. In fact, it makes me want to come over and be with you. And I thought, okay, this dog can sense when I'm feeling this desperate sorrow. And if I trust that this is real and that he can be my companion, like, the sky's the limit if I can trust that and if that's real. And so I decided in that moment to just do one hopeful thing, which was to trust that. And he did it his whole life. He lived to be 11 years old, and he was my little healer for me and other people.
You, of course, do in fact achieve remarkable recovery. You go on to marry a wonderful guy. You're a mother of two daughters now, and of course, a successful writer. And for much of that journey back to fuller health was this beautiful dog. One of the realities of owning a dog is we almost certainly outlive them. And most people, from the moment they get a dog, I mean, somewhere deep inside them is the reality that someday I'm going to have to let this dog go. Can you just say a word about that point of the story? Mm-hmm. And if you feared that losing Bunker was in some ways going to be sort of the beginning of another dark chapter, a return to where you had been before. I mean, how did you know that the brighter place in which you were could still belong to you, mm-hmm. even as you had to let go of Bunker?
You know, I didn't know. But I was a young mother when he died. I had a 2-year-old, and I was pregnant with my second daughter. And I had to go on for them, but, you know, I didn't know that I would be okay. And the day after Bunker died, you know, I had been writing, I'd got an MFA, and I'd been trying to write and sort of struggling and not feeling good about it at all. But the day after Bunker died, I found out that I was a finalist in a pretty prestigious writing contest that I'd honestly forgotten I'd even entered. And the first thought that came into my head when I found out that news was, first of all, that it was a gift from Bunker. His first day in the afterlife, he sent me that. And also, it was a directive from him saying, tell our story. this is the truest thing you know, tell our story. And I felt like that was a real thing. I felt like this timing is not an accident. And, you know, so I have continued on the teaching that he brought to me through writing. And so it kind of became that writing our story started to save me. And it has. You know, he died 9 years ago. And I still feel his presence as strong as if he were sitting right next to me.
Hmm. I know our time is up. Do you have time for just one or two real quick questions?
Yes, definitely.
Thank you. I think it's important for us to reiterate some advice that you share in your book that is that for as heartwarming, as beautiful as this story is, we should not take away the lesson that anybody with chronic depression should run out and buy a puppy. It turned out to be exactly what you needed, but that in fact this is not always the right answer for someone else in this position. Can you say a word about that?
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, people have asked me, you know, do you recommend that, you know, someone who's diagnosed with depression or suffering should go out and get a dog and that'll help? And the answer is absolutely not. No, not unless. Think about that thing when you were a child that just lit you up, that you know, you were so excited about, you know, when you got home. Was it going and, you know, working on a model airplane, or was it going to, you know, see the dog, or was it going to draw or paint? You know, there's something that is your passion and that makes you feel like you're okay, and things make sense when this thing is around, whether it's, you know, art or I don't know, you know, hiking, meditation, all kinds of ways that we can find healing. And it's different for everybody. It really is. So find that thing, you know, and unapologetically follow it, right? You know, like for me, it was having a dog that was my lifeline. And so my dog was my priority in my life because he was the thing that saved me and who helped me and helped me feel like things are good. Life is good. The world is good. I'm happy to come home, because what better way to be greeted than by this beautiful dog who thinks I'm the world's best thing on earth. But it's not the same for everybody. But everybody does have that thing. And even if it seems like something, you know, maybe you love computers and you think, well, I can't just be on computers all the time. Well, maybe you could. Maybe you could find a huge community that is going to be the way that, you know, you connect with the world and help you feel, you know, whole and real. And, you know, depression is a serious and fatal disease, and it's invisible. And it's so important that we take care of each other and of ourselves, and that you follow what makes you happy, no matter what it is.
Right.
No matter what it is.
I love the moment when you describe you've just gotten Bunker, and you say the moment you lifted him, it was as if the moment I picked him up, I felt lifted.
Mm-hmm.
Now,
yep.
Somebody else might pick up a puppy and not feel that. I mean,
yeah.
Instead feel like, oh my gosh, I am weighed down with a terrible burden I'm not ready for, or a responsibility that is beyond who I am.
Absolutely.
And but whatever that thing is that you need to pick up that is going to ultimately lift you up, that's the thing you want people to find.
Exactly.
I know that you have a different dog now named Jackson.
Mm-hmm.
I don't remember if I learned that from the book or from maybe an article I'd read or something, but a dog very different from Bunker. And, of course, that's also a reality when one owns a dog, is that dogs are each their own being and their own sort of personality. And it sounds like Jackson has been a stimulating challenge for you.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, we're his fourth home. He's a little rescue mutt. And, you know, we had to be his medicine. You know, he has a lot of separation anxiety, although he's gotten over that pretty much. But anytime I'm sad or emotional or upset, he runs to the other end of the house and hides. So he is not, a medicine dog in that way. But I do think he has some things to teach us about resilience and trusting. And he trusts us now. I mean, he's my shadow. He follows me everywhere.
Hmm. And here's the last thing I want to ask you. You said at one point in writing this book, I wanted to truly honor how deeply I was suffering. I think it's important because I think this book is different from others that might be, you know, vaguely similar, that are mostly feel-good books about this cute dog. And you have not, it seems to me, shirked your responsibility of also sharing the more painful side of this story and honestly shared about sort of the harshest realities that are part of your story. Was that a difficult choice for you to make, or did that feel like almost an inevitability, that that was the only way you could possibly tell your story, is to include even those darker colors in the telling?
Yeah, it, you know, it is hard. It's very hard because, you know, you think, well, no, who's going to want to read about how awful this was? But one of the ways that you can be kind to yourself and treat yourself with respect is to honor how terribly difficult some things you've been through have been. For to go through something really challenging, really hard, and come out and say, well, it was fine, I'm okay now, is in a way dismissing your pain, you know? And when you go, yeah, that was really hard. That was really hard, and I got through it, but I'm not going to minimize how hard it was. It's a way of honoring, you know, your truth. And also, when it comes to storytelling, it's a way to reach out to other people, because a lot of people, you know, it's scary to do. And you may not want to say, you know, here's what I did. I went into the shower and I sank on the floor and I howled. You know, who wants to, you know, expose that about themselves? But when you do, there's somebody else out there who's done that exact same thing. He says, oh my gosh, I've been there. And I'm so grateful that you shared that. And, you know, the amount of messages that I get from readers, it means the world to me. I get messages from people just saying, thank you. I thought I was the only one. And I'm just so grateful that you shared so deeply and so honestly.
The book again is Dog Medicine, How My Dog Saved Me From Myself, published by Penguin Books, the author Julie Barton. Julie Barton, thank you so much for writing this wonderful book and for talking about it today on The Morning Show. This was my pleasure.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
Many people think a lot these days about tracing back their family roots. And one resource to which you might want to turn, a book which, if anything, will inspire you to do so if you've never really thought much about that, or if you've thought about it but don't know sort of where to turn or just exactly how to go about tracing the roots of your own family tree, should take in hand a beautiful and interesting book from the National Geographic Society called Journeys Home, Inspiring Stories Plus Tips and Strategies to Find Your Family History. One of the contributors to this beautiful book is the very gifted Andrew McCarthy. You probably know him as an actor in all kinds of things, including such films as St. Elmo's Fire, Weekend at Bernie's, Pretty in Pink, but I'm sure I've also maybe seen his writing in all kinds of different places. He has been an editor-at-large at National Geographic Travel Magazine. Perhaps you've seen his work in The Atlantic, Wall Street Journal, Men's Journal, and any number of other places. And this gifted writer really offers up some lovely recollections about tracing his own family history and family roots back to Ireland. And perhaps you are acquainted with his acclaimed 2012 memoir, The Longest Way Home. This book, again, is called Journeys Home, Inspiring Stories Plus Tips and Strategies to Find Your Family History. Andrew McCarthy, we welcome you to The Morning Show.
Thanks. Good to be here.
Oh, a quick question before we get directly to the book. I wonder if you could just say a word about this very intriguing career which you have developed in both the realm of acting and films and television, and also all of this marvelous writing that you've done. Was it by design, or does it surprise you that life has taken you in these divergent directions?
No, there's nothing by design here, let me tell you. I fell into both of them. When I was a kid, the first time I acted, I said, there I am, you know, and I pursued it. And then later on, you know, I started to travel, and when I traveled, I had that same feeling. I went like, there I am, and I just pursued it, and then I just started writing about it, because it's just something that grew out of me. And they're the same thing, really, to me. There's this different manifestations of that same impulse of, like, feeling this is who I am. You know, this brings out something in me, and I'm just going to do it. You know, only later did people start to tell me, you know, you can't do that. It doesn't make any sense. And then it is, on the outside, I think, a strange career marriage of being a travel writer and an actor. But to me, they're sort of the same, other sides of the same coin.
How did you first hook up with National Geographic, and what do you do as one of their editors at large?
And I think an editor at large means you don't write for the magazine very often anymore. I think the title is just a way of just saying we value you and you're part of us. You know, I think that's all the title really means, which is very nice. I love being a part of that. I met a fellow named Keith Bellows, who's the editor-in-chief at National Geographic Traveler, years ago at a party, and I just said I had been traveling a lot, and I'd sort of begun to write about travel in a way, not as a journal, but just as sort of just keeping track of what I'd done on my journeys for some reason. And I said to him, you ought to let me write for your magazine. And he said, yeah, you're an actor, dude. And I said, yeah, I'm an actor, but I know how to tell a story. That's what I do for a living. Hmm. And I know how to travel, and I know what travel does, and I know the importance of travel. Because I'm a great believer that travel is sort of a life-changing thing. It's not something frivolous or, you know, for the idle or for the people with disposable income. I think travel is really a valuable use of time. And I don't particularly mean vacationing. I mean going somewhere and seeing and traveling. And so anyway, and then eventually I just said, look, you know, if the story doesn't work out, you don't have to pay me. And he said, oh, well, I can live with that. So I wrote a story for him, and then it worked out, and I wrote more, and then it just sort of grew and took on this life of its own.
This particular book, again called Journeys Home, essentially opens up with a chapter about Ireland and titled A Restless Pull. A young man wanders into his past and creates a new future. And it is a beautifully told story, which actually spans quite a number of years. At one point you say this, my own relationship to my Irish heritage had always been one of casual pride and affectionate, if uninformed, identification. I thought that was really well put, and I suspect you are describing a whole lot of people who are perfectly happy to be Irish-American or Norwegian-American or whatever they happen to be, and yet have never acted upon it any further than those kind of vague feelings. Talk a little more about the extent to which you thought of yourself as Irish, and then how that so dramatically changed the first time you set foot in Ireland itself.
Yeah, I think particularly for Irish Americans, there is a great pride in it, you know, and because so many Irish, you know, fled during the famine and whatnot and came to America and found a life. You know, I can't meet anyone in Ireland who doesn't have a relation in America, you know. So, and I first landed in Ireland sort of by accident back in the mid-80s. I was working on a film, and then I was in London, and I just sort of went to Ireland for the weekend and stayed a month. I felt, you know, that feeling that we can sometimes feel in the world, I felt more at home than I felt at home somehow there. And I loved it. But again, you know, I felt like I had enough trouble with the family I had. I didn't need to go looking for more, as it were. So it never really occurred to me to go looking for them. But I think it's one of those things that happens when we get older, too. We start having kids of our own. Those kind of things start to have, I'm curious. I wonder, you know. And when I did start digging a little bit, it was much easier than I thought it would be, particularly in Ireland, where the Catholic Church kept such diligent records of marriages and baptisms and that kind of thing. Once you start uncovering it, it was fairly easy. And, you know, what I uncovered was I'd always thought I was from County Cork, and it turned out I was from County Kerry, which may mean nothing to us, but it's a bit like growing up a Yankee fan and then one day realizing you should have been rooting for the Boston Red Sox your whole life. It's very traumatic news. And but it did it turned my perception of who I was in a certain way on its ear, and my relationship to Ireland. You know, and then when I went back, and I found on paper the land where my great-great-grandfather had been and left in 1850 to come to America. And I thought I'd go there, and I thought it might be nice to walk the land, and maybe that would stir something. But it turns out the house that he grew up in was still there, and it was still being inhabited by my second cousin once removed. And so I went there, and we had this crazy sort of wondrous reunion. She'd called all her cousins and sisters, and it turned out there were, you know, 25 of us on that day. I pulled up on the driveway, and they were all standing on the stoop, and I was like, oh my God, what have I gotten into? But it was a wonderful, wonderful surprise. And, you know, it's very strange. It's like these people are all strangers, and yet somehow they didn't feel like strangers. Family's a very complicated and, you know, can be a wondrous thing, you know, and it stayed with me. That journey was about a year and a half ago, I guess, now, and it has stayed with me in certain ways, and I think it's helped me understand certain aspects of myself and a certain comfort in my place in the world that I'm surprised at.
Hmm. One of the things you mentioned is that you made this initial trip to Ireland, fell in love with the place, returned again and again with a good friend of yours, and then at some point you stopped going to Ireland. You started going to other places. You said, a whole decade at least went by. You said Ireland was the first place outside the U.S. that I felt comfortable, and that comfort gave me the confidence to expand your horizons. So you tell us you traveled to all kinds of places, nearly every continent on the globe, before you finally made your way back to Ireland. Not everybody has the means, of course, to do traveling on that sort of scale, but even if you don't, that probably echoes to some extent a lot of people's experiences. And then at some point it's time to return to your roots, in a sense, as you did.
Well, I do think, you know, you have to leave home to go home. But just to go back to one thing, I think I've done the math, and I can go traveling for a lot cheaper than I can stay at home at times. I don't think traveling is to stay in five-star luxury hotels. I have, and you can travel very cheaply, you know, and very close. I think the closer to the ground you travel, the better experience you have. I mean, I don't want some concierge telling me my experience. I'd much rather meet that crazy waiter. You know, that's what I'm going to remember. So I think traveling, people hide behind expense and time. And I, you know, I've gone to New Zealand for a weekend, which is crazy, of course. But it also is a fantastic weekend. And I think people can travel a lot more than they do. And I think we should. I think Americans have a fear of travel and a fear of the world that is unfounded. And I think when we go, you know, Mark Twain had this great line, travel is fatal to prejudice, bigotry, and narrow-mindedness. And I think that's very true.
Right.
And I think Americans would really benefit from getting out in the world.
You also say another interesting thing about Americans. You say that in trying to explain why you initially resisted your wife's urging for you to really aggressively pursue your own family's roots, saying maybe it's the American notion of always looking forward, the idea that what's in the rearview mirror doesn't matter. And I thought that was a really interesting observation I'd not really pondered before. And for someone who has explored this, I think your advice is if people have that sort of notion or attitude, they maybe should think about discarding it.
Well, I do think one of the great things about America is that we are always forward-looking. What's next? What's next? How do we, you know, and that's what's made America American in a certain way. You know, the old rap on Europe used to be that it was always looking back, and America was always looking forward. And I do think Americans are very forward-looking, and it's made us who we are, you know. But I do think at a certain point, look back but don't stare is a good piece of advice, because we can gather wisdom from the past that can help us in the future, you know. And I think for me, going back and looking for my family, and I thought I was the least likely person to do that. I really had no interest. And once I did, I found, wow, it's not what I thought. And it affects me in a positive way that I, you know, and an exciting way. It's been like a treasure hunt, you know. It's like you just keep uncovering it. How long is a piece of string? It's interesting.
The book, we should hasten to clarify for our listeners, takes us all around the world: Japan, India, Croatia, Cambodia, the Philippines, Peru, Mexico, Tanzania, and even right back here to the USA and to the state of Illinois in the last chapter. And so
the very
all kinds
exotic land of Illinois, yeah.
Right? All kinds of different experiences are shared. Beautiful, beautiful photography. If people are thinking about doing this, about tracing their roots in another place, what are a couple of your most valuable tips? I suspect one of them is, if you can, go there. Go to the place where those roots actually are.
Well, I think you can do, you know, luckily now online you can do so much, and I'm terrible on the computer, but I found it much easier than I thought it would be. And I think it's one of those things, if you just begin, you start to, connections start to happen, and then the excitement begins to build. And then, of course, going to a place, you know, makes it a very real experience. I think just showing up and beginning when you hit the ground can be a little daunting. But I'd done a lot of the work before I hit the ground, and so I knew where I wanted to go. But I certainly do think going back and physically experiencing something is no comparison to that. And in the book, I think there's a lot of sort of helpful kind of tips on how people can begin and who to contact. And who, there are a lot of resources out there to help people now find that.
The book, again, is Journeys Home, Inspiring Stories Plus Tips and Strategies to Find Your Family History from the good folks at National Geographic. And Andrew McCarthy, I thank you so much. This was fun to speak with you, and best wishes and safe travels.
Thank you.
And once again, support for